It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, WPR turns 100 this year, and as part of the celebrations, listeners are invited to decode Morse code messages during airings of old-time radio drama. We'll get a taste of Morse code and hear about the contest coming up.
First, an audit released yesterday reveals that the Wisconsin Department of Transportation significantly underestimated the real costs of several highway projects and failed to properly manage expenses.
The costs of some of those road projects doubled between planning and implementation, the audit reveals. Joint Audit Committee co-chair Senator Robert Coles, Republican from Green Bay, said the findings were unacceptable. He called for the DOT to streamline its practices and be more accountable to taxpayers. Jesse Opoyan joins us now. She's state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, throw some numbers at us. What kind of underestimates are we talking about here?
Oh, man, we've got so many numbers. So the audit looked at a lot of different aspects here, but to start off with those cost underestimates, they looked at some ongoing projects and they looked at some projects that have been completed. So like you mentioned, those estimates that doubled in cost, those are for 19 projects that have already been completed. They found that the DOT underestimated costs by about $772 million over the last 10 years. They also looked at 16 ongoing major highway projects, and those cost estimates were short about $3.1 billion. And they found that's because the DOT wasn't accounting for the extent to which inflation would influence those expenses and the potential addition of just unexpected expenses along the way.
So this isn't just a matter of vast, these projects are going on longer and more expensive than they thought. It isn't just that. It's also maybe those calculations up front weren't right, in part because, as you say, of inflation.
Exactly.
And this comes at a time when we're wondering how we're going to pay for our transportation budget as it is. So this throws a big monkey wrench into what people have been talking about so far, right?
It does. This debate's been going on for a while as we head into the budget. Governor Walker is set to deliver his budget address early in February, so we're all waiting to see what comes from that. We've obviously seen some indications of what he's going to put forward and what legislators would like to see from that, but we're already looking at a $1 billion shortfall in the transportation budget, and there's not much agreement at this point over how to fund just that. So the addition of all of these new numbers, new potential problems, throws some interesting twists into that argument.
Talking to Jesse Opoyan from the Capital Times about a new audit of the state's Department of Transportation, how it spends money on roads. Jesse, we talked about those underestimates. That's not the only part of this audit that people are talking about. There's also the issue of bidding. The audit saying, hey, we had opportunities to save money up front if we'd been a little more careful, and we didn't. What did we hear about that?
Yeah, there's a couple ways that that could have changed things, it looks like, but one of the more significant ones is just on projects where DOT only got one bid on the project. If they had just gotten more than one bid, the audit found they could have saved just shy of $45 million. So things like that, where the opportunity is there to take that extra step and just wasn't taken, could have resulted in some savings over the last few years.
What's been talked about a lot with the whole road funding issue is the quality of Wisconsin's roads and the potential damaged roads if we put out projects. Did the audit look at road quality at all?
Yeah, it did. It looked at it within the state, and it also compared it to other Midwestern states and the rest of the country. So it found from looking at it, 2010, the percentage of the state's roads that were considered to be in good condition was 53.5%. That's down in 2015. That went down to 41%. And looking at the flip side of that, the roads that were considered to be in poor quality or worse, that was at 7% in 2010 and was up to 17.5% in 2015. So those numbers put Wisconsin behind six other Midwestern states. We're always looking at how Wisconsin stacks up to states like Minnesota, Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin falls behind all of those states.
What kind of reactions are we hearing? First of all, from Republicans, this has not been a partisan issue necessarily. There's been tension within the Republican Party over how to pay for transportation. What are we hearing on the Republican side?
Yeah, that tension is definitely stemmed mostly from Assembly Republicans. We've seen Senate Republicans a lot more likely to line up behind Governor Walker and his pledge to not raise gas taxes or vehicle registration fees in the budget, while Assembly Republicans have been saying need to keep all options on the table, not necessarily coming out in favor of one over another. But reactions sort of follow those along those lines. Governor Walker said this audit shows that there are additional savings that can be found within the DOT, and that this just sort of provides an opportunity to further explore that before looking at any fee or tax increases. Speaker Robin Voss said his takeaway from this was that project delays are leading to increased costs. The Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, was not pleased with the audit, but said that this can be used as sort of a roadmap to implement the Audit Bureau's recommendations for the legislature to maybe put some better guidelines in place.
And then how about Democrats in the legislature? What have we been hearing from them?
Democrats across the board were pretty quick to blame this on the Republican majority. Of course, Republicans have been in control of state government for the last 6 years, so the reactions from Democrats were fairly similar in that they said that this is just evidence that Republicans are passing up another chance to find a long-term solution to the transportation fund, and that this is a problem for them to solve, and not necessarily coming forward with their own recommendations at this point, kind of waiting to see how Republicans let this play out.
We have a new boss at the DOT, Gottlieb out, Ross in, just over the course of the new year, basically. With that in place, with this audit out, is there a sense that we're going to see the DOT change the way it does a lot of things, including bidding and cost estimates?
Yeah, it's unclear at this point, but his response was, of course, he was thankful for this audit, giving him an opportunity, a roadmap to find, better efficiencies to be more transparent about the DOT's practices. So it certainly indicates that he's interested in following some of those recommendations from the report. And I think, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle were fairly optimistic that this might might lead to some changes.
What are you looking for, especially as the state budget gets released over the next couple of weeks?
Well, it's going to be, we've seen what Governor Walker's administration wants. In September that was released, that early plan, and we know what that looks like. So we'll be looking to see if that changes at all. Assembly Republicans have said that they'd like to see $300 million in increased revenue, that they would find a way to offset that somewhere in the budget to fall within the governor's guidelines. The question is, where do they want that $300 million to come from? And where do the lines fall on this? Does it become something where Democrats are needed to find a solution, or is it something that can be dealt with within the Republican majority?
We'll leave it there for now. Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jesse Opoyan, state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times, giving us some of the details of this new audit of the State Department of Transportation that was just released yesterday. Wisconsin Public Radio turns 100 years old this year.
It's been a century since broadcast pioneer Professor Earl Terry and his students transmitted the first broadcast from Sterling Hall on the UW campus to a group of friends and colleagues gathered together at Terry's house.
As the story goes, the guests were pretty underwhelmed by the faint sounds of a classical piano tune coming through the receiver.
Few people at the time could foresee how wireless radio would revolutionize communication. Up to that point, Terry and his students had been transmitting messages via Morse code.
As part of an on-air celebration to honor our 100th anniversary, WPR listeners will periodically hear simple Morse code messages during episodes of old-time radio drama that starts this Sunday night, and they'll be challenged to decode them. Here is a sample.
No idea what that means, but maybe we'll find out. Well, two WPR colleagues are here with me in studio, Norman Gilliland and Dave Potrazer, the brains behind this idea. Norman Gilliland is the host and producer of old-time radio drama and The Midday, and he's also a reader for Chapter a Day. Norman, welcome.
Thank you, Veronica.
And Dave Potraz is a WPR network operator and announcer, and from time to time he's here helping out, being a technical director on Central Time as well. And Dave, good to have you on this side of the board.
Thank you very much, Veronica. Nice to be on this side.
Well, WPR is 100 years old this year. Hard to believe, but in the early days, radio was, you know, a lot different than it is today. Could you paint a picture for us about those early days of radio?
Well, it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, today with the ubiquitous nature of broadcast, you know, television, radio, and the internet now and all that. But back in those days, there was just about nothing going on. There was nothing much to listen to, and not many people were able to listen to it. It wasn't until early experimentation with wireless in around the turn of the last century, in the early 1900s, that anyone at all was able to hear anything over the airwaves, and that was pretty much limited to telegraphic information. It all started with transmitters that were just capable of what they call a spark transmission, just on or off. So really, sound was out of the question at that point, and it wasn't until later that the evolution allowed for voice communication much later. So the same thing with WHA, or the former 9XM experimental station back in the 1917, and we're celebrating that as well, that folks like Edward Bennett and Earl Terry at the university began experimenting with this new technology. And, of course, they used the already well-established Morse code to transmit messages over the air.
And this, of course, eventually led to the golden age of radio, which I'm sad to say I don't think we're in anymore. I guess we're past that. I'd like to think there's still a golden age happening on Wisconsin Public Radio. But, Norman, tell us about that golden age. What was that like?
Well, you know, I take issue a little bit with the term, although I use it a lot, too, in the sense of radio from 1932 to 1962, when you had millions of listeners and when a show like We Hold These Truths in 1941 could have more than half the population of the country listening to it. I mean, how often does that happen today? I venture to say not at all. So, yes, those were wonderful years, 32 to 62 in particular. You had radio drama being produced and getting more and more elaborate and big-name stars and these huge audiences that listened every week to their favorite shows. But, you know, I would argue also that before that, there was a golden age when the power of radio was just being discovered, and Marconi and his invention could actually, if you read a book by Eric Larson, Thunderstruck, gives you a good idea. I read that for Chapter a Day, and it's a fascinating book about how a wife killer was actually tracked during his escape across the Atlantic to Quebec by wireless. And as soon as he stepped off the boat, they nabbed him. So that was a golden age, too, and we're arguably in a golden age now, too. The medium of dissemination varies, but there's so much programming, so much diversity, and so many opportunities still that this is a golden age, too, I say.
I like that read on it, Norman. And for your program, All Time Radio Drama, do you draw most of what you play? I mean, you produce some new things, too. You're keeping the art alive. But the stuff that you draw from the archives, where does that tend to come from?
It comes from all over the place. There's one collector in particular who is an incredible collector, by which I mean by the U-Haul load. But he's also very discriminating in terms of the audio quality. And for many years, he has totally out of the goodness of his heart and for the sake of the medium and the art provided these things, a lot of them, a lot of the best audio for me for old-time radio.
Do they come from that 30s to 60s window?
Yeah. I would say 99.8% from between 1932 and 1962.
And I guess what made this technology that we're talking about possible, something called crystal radio, not something I knew very much about at all, but tell us about crystal radio, what that is.
Yes, indeed. The crystal radio, it's really the most basic form of radio, and it's really fascinating and I guess egalitarian in a way. Virtually anyone can construct a crystal radio, or could back in the day, and that was basically the only form of radio that was available available tube receivers didn't come until much later, but it could be constructed with just a few inexpensive parts, a wire for an antenna, a copper coil of wire to receive the radio waves, and something called a crystal detector. That was kind of the heart of the radio, and that consisted back in the day in the earliest form of what was called colloquially a cat's whisker, and all it was a wire that you placed against a rock. A piece of galena crystal was used, and if you placed it properly, you would detect the signal. And what that essentially was changing the form of the incoming radio wave to a form that could be heard over a simple pair of earphones. You didn't have loudspeakers like we do today and amplifiers and things like that. So it's just a very simple form. But it was the groundswell of basically grassroots hobbyists, enthusiasts, students, farmers were involved in this as well to construct these sets. And I think what came after that was the gee whiz factor. You know, once you heard one, you listen to this, and then you probably wanted to build your own, you know, back in the day. And it was that groundswell, I think, that kind of fed back and forth. There was a feedback loop between what was being transmitted back in the early days of 9XM, as we know. It was basically the weather report, and crop prices were the first broadcast that we had. But essentially, a public service way back then. So I think what we were seeing was the dawn of public radio.
I see where you're going.
Days. Yes.
Yeah, and radios were expensive too, right? So this isn't the kind of thing that you could just pick up.
They could be. Some, like a crystal set, you could build very inexpensively. But on the other hand, if you wanted to get more elaborate, you could certainly do that. And I have a diagram from 1923 that still confounds me of how to build your own radio. It's good luck, my friend.
So it's much cheaper to build it yourself than to buy it from a store. So, Dave, you're getting at Crystal Radio's birth in the beginnings of public radio where we are today. So, Norman, how did Crystal Radio play into public radio?
Well, it put radio in the hand of anybody who wanted to express, you know, an interest and get involved in it. And that's, you know, the groundwork for anything, whether it's the internet or radio or the automobile, even to some extent. If you make it a consumer item, suddenly its popularity ramps up. And that's what happened to radio. And then, kind of as Dave was implying, there's a loop there. The more people had radio, the more purpose there was of putting programming on it, and the better the programming got, the more people listened, and on it went, and it really took off in the 20s.
And does it have a connection, do you think, to the Wisconsin idea, public radio, and, you know, the roots, maybe even to what you hear today on Wisconsin public radio?
Oh, thank you for a loaded question.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, University of Wisconsin Extension. Wisconsin Public Radio is part of the UW Extension, and the extension idea is that farmers in particular would listen to the programming and get information that was important to their work. And so it's an outgrowth of that, except now it's not just farmers, nor was it even early on. It expanded very quickly to other interests.
We're talking right now with Dave Potrez, a WPR network operator and announcer, and Norman Gilliland, host and producer of old-time radio drama in the midday. And we're talking about some of the roots of radio, and also, this is all to mark the 100th birthday of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listeners can participate in decoding Morse code messages that will be played during the old-time radio drama program. And let's get to that. You guys brought in some fancy-looking stuff here, and you're going to demonstrate. What have you got with you?
I've put together what was called a code oscillator, and I have a key, and this key is actually 130 years old. And
wow.
I refurbished that and put together a speaker in this case so we could hear it in a tone form. So it's a combination of the old and the new, but the purpose is to be able to generate our own code for Norman's use during old-time radio.
That is so cool. And the speaker would be the thing by the microphone. It's in a glass bell, and it looks like a little disc, a little hockey puck with a hole in it, basically. And that's it, huh?
Well, yeah, that's just the speaker. I kind of wanted to, kind of like borrowing from a Back to the Future line by Dr. Brown. If you're going to make a time machine, you might as well do it with a little style. So we put it together and, you know, might have some flashing lights coming later. And I also want to use that to be able to construct crystal radios in the next couple of months or so, and to be able to use that as kind of a makeshift amplifier for that as well.
Well, can you play it for us? Let's hear some.
Yeah, let's try some.
Okay, was that gibberish, Norman, or did you just say something?
I said what we said at the beginning of this show, Veronica.
Oh, well, you're going to tell us?
W-H-A.
Can I hear it one more time, knowing that? I think it will be imbued with meaning. W-H-A. Very
W-H-A.
Cool.
W-H-A. Yeah, I mean, you know, pardon my pronunciation a little bit. But, yeah, W-H-A.
So tell us, if you will, about this contest that's going to happen on old-time radio drama using Morse code.
Well, in a nutshell, let's see. The Sunday night, the 29th, 8:30, give or take a couple of minutes after the Lone Ranger, we'll send out a short coded message, I can tell you. In fact, it's going to be a single word. We'll invite people to decode that, send their decodings to us via email, and then we'll draw within a week a prize winner from among all of those correct decoders. And we'll be doing this throughout the year as the message develops over the course of the 12 months through December of 2017.
Nice. What's the prize, Norman?
Oh, it's a different prize every month.
Oh, different prizes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool things. And Dave, since you put this together, tell us as we wrap up a little bit about how it works.
Well, the key here, as I say, is a vintage 120 so years old, and basically the oscillator generates a continuous tone that is broken by the key. So when you press the key, you close the circuit and create the tone.
So does anybody still really use Morse code today?
We do.
You guys, yeah. Does anybody else use it? Wasn't there an option on a phone? You can get some phones that have it?
Well, yeah, sometimes, like, you know, certain kind of people with certain disabilities, limited mobility can use Morse code. There have been cases of POWs who, you know, have been interviewed on television and flash out torture in Morse code. True, you know. So, yeah, and sometimes it's easier to transmit great distances than speech.
I've also heard that survivalists learn Morse code in case you're trapped on a desert island or something like that.
That's right.
Flash a signal
so
to an
overlooker. So interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, guys. Thanks for coming by.
Our pleasure.
There's a couple of WPR staffers, Norman Gilliland from Old Time Radio Drama, Dave Protraz, one of our network operators and announcers. And starting this Sunday night, listeners can participate in a decoding Morse code kind of contest on Old Time Radio Drama. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, trade deals have been getting a lot of blame for a decline in American manufacturing jobs, but our guest says technology and automation are a much bigger part of the story.
First, for decades now, there's been plenty of debate over the role of America's military as well as the country's role in international politics. A 2014 Pew Research survey found that Americans believe by a margin of 51% to 17% that the United States does too much, as opposed to too little, in helping solve world problems. It's got some people wondering if it's time to roll back our global military presence.
But our next guest argues that so-called hard power is a necessary tool in the country's foreign policy tool belt, and by pulling back, we risk more global conflict, especially as new and serious threats begin to emerge on the international scene.
Elliot Cohen joins us now. He's a professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. He's a former counselor at the Department of State and the author of several books. His newest is The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. Elliot, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Before we get to the heart of your book, I wanted to throw in some current events. News today that some top State Department officials are out. It's been presented by the Trump administration as standard operating procedure. Some people have said no. Usually people in these posts stick around for a while in the transition. What are you making of this as you watch it?
Well, that's quite true. I mean, usually people do stick around. I know one of them quite well, Patrick Kennedy, was the undersecretary for management when I was there. You know, to lose one senior person, that's more or less normal. To have a whole bunch of them leave simultaneously is not good. I mean, there'll be other long-time career people who can, you know, fill some of the gaps. But I think it's an indication of what's going to be a very rocky time, particularly at the State Department, in some ways throughout the government.
And you made news a while back. You'd been in the Bush administration. You were what people had called a never Trump, Republican or conservative over time. But you had said, hey, people in the foreign policy community still take jobs with this Trump administration. You changed your mind about that. Can you talk through that story?
Sure. Well, I was and I am a never Trumper, I guess. I was the one of the ringleaders in two letters of former officials and conservative foreign policy and national security experts who were very critical of the president. My feeling once the election happened is, well, you know, I was very unhappy that it turned out the way it did, but that they would need good help, and so that people should be willing under certain circumstances to go in, although, as I put it with your signed but undated letter of resignation in your the top drawer of your desk. And then I just had there were a number of things that happened. Part of it was just watching what the transition teams were like and listening to the rhetoric that came out of the Trump camp. And then I had one particular exchange with somebody who I thought I knew quite well on the transition team, which just really gave me the sense that this was a kind of an angry, vindictive, self-righteous group. And I have to say my views have not really changed that much. You know, I think there are some parts of the government, like the Defense Department, where I've got a very high regard for Secretary Mattis. I actually testified to the Senate to help change the law so he could become Secretary of Defense. But I think if you look at the White House and now at some of the things that are happening in the State Department, this is really what's going on is something that's just out of the norm, and it's very disturbing.
Let's get into the heart of your book here, and the big question is when? How often should the United States use military force? What kind of military presence should we have in the world? I think one of the cases Donald Trump made that seemed to appeal to people, and I think Bernie Sanders supporters maybe had a similar thought, was we shouldn't police the world. We shouldn't invest our resources to protect other people. We shouldn't risk American lives to protect other countries. As Donald Trump put it in his inauguration speech, we should stop worrying about them and think about America first. Make the case that that's not the way the United States should proceed.
Okay, well, the first thing, of course, as a lot of your listeners will know, that phrase America first is loaded. That was Charles Lindbergh's phrase when he was going after Franklin Roosevelt for trying to support Great Britain. And it has some pretty unsavory associations as well with pro-Nazi sympathizers. And I have to say, I think that they use that phrase deliberately with an awareness of the historical freight that it carries. There is absolutely a need for a serious argument. In fact, the first chapter of the book is called Why the United States, and I try to deal with a number of the arguments that have been advanced by all kinds of people on both left and right for why the United States should not be in the business of trying to help maintain world order. And the argument boils down to this, the argument for the United States maintaining that role. In the last 70 years, with all of our difficulties, with all of the price that we've paid in blood and treasure, the world has seen spectacular prosperity, hundreds of billions, indeed billions of people coming out of poverty, tremendous prosperity for the United States, which is, after all, the wealthiest nation in the world. But none of that is automatic, and that was the product of statesmanship of both Republicans and Democrats ever since we got into World War II. And to throw that away is to really risk some very ugly things. I think one of the things that troubles me most is that we've lost a sense for what a real catastrophe could look like, the kinds of things that happened in the 1930s, except in some ways humanity can do a lot more damage to itself today with nuclear weapons than was possible even back then. So that's a kind of a shorthand version of a longer argument, which is really right at the outset of the book.
Talking to Elliot Cohen. His new book is The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. And Elliot, when people think of American military intervention these days, I think you might be right. They don't think back to what led up to World War II. The big example in recent memory is the Iraq War, the more recent of the two. And you were an advocate for that, and people look back and say we used intelligence that turned out not to be right, maybe prioritized the wrong intelligence. We went in thinking words like cakewalk, greeted as liberators. It ended up being, for many years, a quagmire, a longer involvement than we thought, a more damaging one, and now we have ISIS. How would you address those concerns? People say, look at Iraq. We shouldn't be having this aggressive, this powerful military presence.
Well, again, there's a longer discussion of that in a chapter called 15 Years of War, which I really try to take on as honestly as I can. The question of what should we take away from the experience of really three wars, which were linked in a variety of ways, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, and the kind of global war against various jihadi elements. And you know, my bottom line on Iraq was taking one thing with another. I think, you know, my personal view is that it was a mistake, certainly, to do it the way we did it, although I understand what the argument's for. And it was not just – it was not simply driven, I think, by some of the intelligence failures. It was – terms like cakewalk, which I never used, were inappropriate. On the other hand, it is true we were greeted like liberators. I mean, if you were talk to anybody who served in the march up from Kuwait through places like Nasiriyah, that is the case. And I think the record in Iraq is actually pretty complicated. Moreover, I don't believe that Iraq had to turn out the way it turned out. To support that, I would do is point to the judgment of some of the career diplomats who were actually not in favor of the Iraq War, but who knew that country well and who served there. People like Ambassador Ryan Crocker, Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, these are old Middle East hands. Their judgment in 2008, which was when I was in government and going to Iraq quite a bit, I would add, was that place was on a fragile trajectory to success. It didn't have to turn out the way that it turned out. But that's it. There's no question that it's been frustrating for people. I kind of push back on the term war weariness because I think you're entitled to be war weary if you serve there or if you have a family member who served there. And for sure, you know, if you're a family of somebody who fell or who was badly wounded, or if you're in that position yourself. And the rest of us have not really paid a price for these wars. We haven't even paid it in taxes. But I think it is a more complicated record and was a more complicated war than people realize. This is the sort of thing that, frankly, we're only going to sort out with some considerable historical perspective. On the other hand, it's also important to remember that there are things that happen when you don't act. And for that, you need look no further than Syria, where essentially we did nothing. 500,000 dead, 12 million displaced people, a major destabilizing political crisis in the broader Middle East and indeed in Europe with refugee flows, the Russians reestablishing themselves in the Middle East and doing some terrible things as they do it. So the dilemma of American power is not to act is a decision too, and it has consequences too. We're just sort of stuck with that.
We're talking right now with Strategic Studies Professor Elliot Cohen. In his new book, The Big Stick, he argues that American military power remains crucial as ever, and makes the case that so-called hard power, military power, not soft power, is often what's needed to face today's biggest foreign policy challenges.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think America's role should be abroad? And do you agree with our guest about the need for a strong global military presence? And when it comes to the use of force, when should that be utilized and when shouldn't it? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're talking right now with Elliot Cohen, author of The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. He argues that American military power remains as crucial as ever, especially as new threats emerge on the global scene.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the United States maintain a strong military presence around the world and be ready, if the situation warrants, to use military force? When should we not do that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Jeremy is on the line in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My concern is anytime you have a state that continues to build up a military power such as the United States, such a manner and such a scale, it only produces a persona of aggression throughout the world. A lot of states around the world are trying to figure out why is the United States rolling out 13 brand new carriers, new F-35 fighter jets. I mean, the scale of military buildup that we do in our country is just makes everybody else minuscule compared to what we do.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. I want to bring Elliot in on this. Jeremy's saying our military build-ups inspire other countries to build up as much as they can in kind, maybe increasing tension.
Well, I guess I disagree for a number of reasons. I think first, you know, if you simply talk to our allies in Europe, Britain or Poland, at the moment they're much more concerned about American retreat than anything else. And the same thing would go for the Japanese and the Australians and the Singaporeans, and I could go on and on. Second thing is that just factually not correct. I mean, the United States is not building 13 new aircraft carriers. We're actually have been slower in modernizing the equipment that we have than, say, the Russians or the Chinese. And one of the things I try to talk about in the book, but I've got a chapter on China, for example, the fact is the Chinese have been sinking really vast sums of money into brand new military technology. And it's probably a mistake for us to assume that we have this overwhelming edge. We don't. And that's actually going to be a very serious challenge for American defense planners going ahead. So it really isn't true that we've been engaged in anything remotely like a defense buildup. Actually, in many ways, we've been spending less than we need to. And other countries are indeed ramping up.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Charlie in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for your guest is that it seems that a lot of the U.S. policies, from their trade deals to their military interventions and foreign policy interventions, have enriched the world as a whole. Yes, the global wealth has increased, and yes, many places on the earth have obviously done better. The real question, though, is that the reason for Trump's success is that a lot of people in America have been left behind. And that's where the anger comes from. And so while I don't disagree with the previous policies, how do we encourage and how do we bring up everybody else so that they feel part of the benefits and not just feeling the bad parts?
Charlie, thanks. So how do we sell the benefits of American military policy around the world to Americans, Elliot?
Well, I think there really are two issues, and I think, you know, you've made a very powerful point, Charlie. The first is I think we need to understand the United States is actually not spending by historical standards disproportionate amount of money on defense. And the challenges that we face domestically are things that have to be addressed domestically, and they have to do with education, they have to do with all kinds of things that either foster or limit economic growth, automation factors, all sorts of things which are not really affected, actually, I think, by defense spending. But I think there's a larger point which you're raising, which I try to talk about in the book, and that is, in a way, the debate we're now having about the use of American military power should have been triggered by the end of the Cold War, because after all, there was a kind of a consensus that we needed to stand up to the Soviets. But after the Cold War, it was perfectly legitimate to have that debate. We didn't have it because in the 1990s, predominance was cheap and the economy was flourishing. Then we had the emergencies of the early 2000s. So in a way, we're having a belated discussion about American foreign policy. And the truth is that I think our leaders on both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, got lazy in terms of making the case to the American people why this is important. The fact of the matter is that at the end of the day, you know, I'm not trying to minimize the distress in some parts of the United States. The fact is we're an exceptionally wealthy country. We're the wealthiest in the world. And it's not as the choice is really a false choice between having a substantial military and a global role with domestic prosperity. I mean, we really managed it throughout most of the Cold War, for example.
Charlie, thanks for the call. We're talking to Elliot Cohen. His new book is The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. We go next to Rick on the line in Milwaukee. Rick, hi.
How you doing? So my father served in World War II. He was decorated. My uncles, et cetera, and I used to debate with them. One of the things that they brought up was the United States was becoming, and this is we're talking, when I was talking to them in the 80s, we're becoming like Rome. You know, if you ever read the book, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, becoming imperialist, feeling that our way of life is the best, imposing on other people's cultures, trying to Americanize them. And again, causing more resentment than cooperation. So, you know, I guess to my point, there's a point where another foreign friend of mine said, we used to be like the big brother that protected them. Now we're like the big brother who turned into a bully. So I really feel we need to pull back a little bit and allow other cultures and other countries to take care of their own issues.
Rick, thanks. Elliot?
Well, again, you know, I'd point out the fact that our allies actually want more of a presence rather than less of a presence. I don't think we end up actually imposing our values on people the way some suggest. And to the extent we have an influence, it's quite often benign. Let me give you an example that people may not think about, and that is our relationship with Colombia, which has gone through this terrible civil war for almost 50 years, where the government has finally won against an extremely brutal organization, the FARC. And that was the reason for their success was their own efforts, but we played a very important role in supporting and training and advising the Colombian military. And Colombian generals will tell you that one of the benefits was one of the benefits of the United States military training the Colombian military and being an example for them was actually limiting and driving down human rights abuses towards the local population. And, you know, the Colombian military ended up emulating a lot of American standards. It wasn't because it was imposed on them. It was because they were impressed by it. And the truth is also we, to some extent, our military aid was going to be conditional on certain things. So spreading certain kinds of military American values in that way is not entirely a bad thing.
Thanks again for the call. As we start to wrap up, Elliot, you point toward an alternative being America keeps its strong role in the world, or we risk anarchy and a lot of threats increasing and spiraling out of control. Lay out what you see as a worst case.
Well, the thing is, there is no power that can simply replace the United States as the kind of the leader of global order. I think instead what you'd be much more likely to get is a certain amount of chaos. We've already seen with Russia in the Ukraine, we've seen with China in the South China Sea, that there are plenty of countries which are willing to use force to get their way with their neighbors. And that'll have all kinds of consequences, the spread of nuclear weapons, and then I think eventually wars. You know, the thing I'd point out to people is this. There's no question, absolutely no question, that President Obama really wanted to retrench, was really averse to the use of military force, really thought he could end our wars. And yet, look what happened. He launched our third war in Iraq. He doubled down in Afghanistan. He vastly expanded a campaign of targeted killing against al-Qaeda and similar groups. He deployed American ships near the Chinese islands in the South China Sea, and he's reintroduced substantial forces into Europe. Now, he's not doing this because he's a hypocrite, and he's not doing this – didn't do that because he didn't care about those values. He did. But I think what he found was that the logic of circumstances meant that he had to. And I think the choice that we're going to face is ultimately the choice that we faced in the 1930s. Do you get engaged early when the price is lower and your chance of success is greater? Or do you get engaged at the last minute when the price is a lot higher and the chances of success are a lot more uncertain?
We'll leave it there. Elliot, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure being with you.
We've been talking to Elliot Cohen. He's professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies and author of The Big Stick, Limits of Soft Power and the Necessity of Military Force. Still time to share your thoughts on this conversation over at the Central Time Facebook page. Do you agree with Elliot Cohen that the United States should keep a strong military presence around the world as a deterrent and possibly as a military response? Or do you think we should dial back and focus more on things here at home? Let the chips fall where they may around the world. And what are you hoping for or fearing from the new presidential administration of Donald Trump and his team? Again, you can share your thoughts. If you're brief, tweet us at Central Time WPR or post at whatever length you care to over on the Central Time Facebook page.
New research from Japan is adding fuel to the fire in the ongoing debate, cats versus dogs. Who's smarter?
The general consensus has been that dogs are smarter, at least in terms of memory. But in research published in the journal Behavioral Processes, cats performed really well on memory tests, like remembering which bowls of food they'd found their favorite food or treats in.
Researchers say the cats demonstrated what's called episodic memory, remembering where things happened and what happened there. And they did as well as dogs did. Plus, they say cats do as well as dogs on other mental tests, including responding to visual and behavioral cues from humans.
Now, I don't have a cat or a dog now. I've had cats, and I question this research a little bit. Like, a cat after 12 years hasn't figured out that if it pounces on my face while I'm sleeping, it's going to get nudged off the bed and still does it.
I'm
not seeing that as a for, or maybe...
The cat knows that it's pouncing on your face. It just enjoys it, A. And B, cats are very smart. I think that dogs and cats are smart, but my mom has a cat named Frederick. Hey, mm-hmm. Frederick, he's super smart. He can, if he had
opposable...
He
turn on a radio,
if
apparently.
He had opposable thumbs, uh-huh. You know, he could open doors. There's no telling what he'd be doing. I mean, he's just limited by anatomy, but I'd say cats are pretty darn smart.
Well, let me be the first to welcome our new cat overlords. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.